The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wolgamont, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes of our meeting from January 3rd, 2023, and I would like to move that they be adopted.
Any discussion to the Wolgamont motion, who was present at the last committee meeting on his motion to approve the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
Thank you for your support, members.
Members, today we have the Office of Higher Education and the Governor's Budget. So would I would ask the Commissioner Olson and whoever he needs to be with him to come up and introduce themselves to the committee and proceed with the presentation on the Governor's Budget. And members will allow questioning at any time, so if you have a question, let me know and we'll let you bring the question up. Welcome to the committee and please identify yourself for the record.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson and I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I'm joined this morning by my colleagues, Dr. Wendy Robinson, Assistant Commissioner, and Nikki Oliver, Director of Grants and Government Relations. Of course, they'll introduce themselves when the time comes, but Mr. Chair and members, overall, just thank you for the opportunity to share the governor's higher education budget recommendations with you this morning. As you all well know, higher education is the cornerstone of opportunity for Minnesotans. Whether a person pursues a certificate, an associate's, a bachelor's, or another type of credential, pursuing post-secondary education can greatly benefit a person's career and earning options over the course of their lifetime. We have a chance this session to truly invest in Minnesota higher education, and at $335 million over the next biennium, the budget recommendation would further our efforts to break down financial barriers and ensure everyone sees higher education as an option. I know you've already heard, Mr. Chair and members, from Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota about their budget requests, so I plan to primarily focus today's presentation around the Office of Higher Education's portion of the governor's recommendations. And many of you have heard me refer to our agency as small but mighty. Our work not only supports two-year, four-year public, private, and tribal colleges in the state, but we also work closely with numerous organizations and agencies to support their work around access to higher education as well as overall economic development in the state of Minnesota. Investing in our work, of course, is an investment in the vitality of our state. While Minnesota is frequently cited as a state with high-quality higher education and overall higher education attainment, we know that there are real and significant concerns about declining enrollments for many of our institutions and the persistent attainment gap between white students and students from historically excluded populations is ever present when it comes to completing a post-secondary credential. As we prepare to discuss the governor's budget recommendations, it's important to note that there are no easy fixes when it comes to solving the problems of enrollment and attainment. Because declining enrollment builds upon itself, it will likely take several years of strategic investment by the state, combined with thoughtful enrollment management strategies from our colleges and universities to return to peak enrollment levels. Our ability to close the attainment gap rests in part on reversing the declining enrollment trends, especially for the populations most impacted by the pandemic. Reversing declining enrollment trends and addressing the attainment gap requires, of course, a multi-pronged approach that includes support for adult learners, support for part-time students, students with unique barriers to higher education, and increasing affordability for low and middle income students. So, Mr. Chair and members, our presentation will provide an analysis of governor's budget priorities organized around three key themes: affordability, access, and attainment, as well as the resources needed to support the agency operations at the Office of Higher Education and, of course, our public university systems. So, next slide. So, Mr. Chair, members, we're first going to discuss the governor's budget recommendations that aim to address affordability. As you've heard many times through testimony already throughout session, affordability is a primary concern for anyone considering higher education. So the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's budget focuses investment in the Minnesota State Grant Program, which supports students at public, private, and tribal campuses in the state, as well as making targeted investments in supporting our tribal colleges and American Indian students. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Robinson to walk through the first two proposals.
Commissioner, before we turn it over, I appreciate that you mentioned numerous times declining enrollment. You know that this committee has taken a look at the MinState declining enrollment campus by campus. We took a look this week at the University of Minnesota and it's declining enrollment campus by campus with the exception of the main campus in Minneapolis. It is of great concern to this committee that whatever we do with the budget by the end of session, that we begin a process to reverse the declining enrollment and bring stability back to higher education. So I want to make sure that the governor understands we're willing to work with the governor, but declining enrollment is probably the biggest issue that we're facing. And with that, we're turning it over to Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Wendy Robinson, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants at the Office of Higher Education. In 2020, the Congress passed the FAFSA Simplification Act, which makes several significant changes to the FAFSA form and Pell eligibility criteria. These changes are designed to both make the FAFSA easier for families to complete and to increase the eligibility of students receiving Pell grants. The Act changes the needs analysis formula and the Pell Grant calculations. Because we use data from the FAFSA to award state aid programs, including the state grant, the Office of Higher Education will need to make changes to policy, processes, and technology in the next several years in order to be compliant and consistent with these federal changes. As a result of the federal changes, we anticipate that there will be an increase in the number of students who will be eligible for the state grant, and as well as also seeing that current state grant recipients may see their state grant award amounts change once these changes, the federal Pell changes, are implemented fully by 2024-2025. The governor recommends $18.7 million in the next biennium to support both necessary IT changes for the state grant system and other state financial aid programs, as well as for expected increases in state grant eligibility as a result of these FAFSA changes.
Mr. Chair, can you ask her
Representative O'Neill.
Can you move your microphone closer, please? Now we can hear you. Thank you so much.
And before we go back to the assistant commissioner, there is a spreadsheet in your packet that may be of some assistance to you. It's the Minnesota House Fiscal Analysis Department, and it's a breakdown of the numbers on one sheet. So members, if you want to get that out in conjunction with what's being presented here today, it would be probably helpful to track numbers as we proceed. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually greatly appreciate having this fiscal analysis sheet for today. But as I'm new to this committee, but what I've always requested in my other committee assignments is that they provide the amount that was allocated in the budget year we're in so we can compare a year over year. I find it challenging to be able to understand these requests without knowing what percent increase or decrease. So if that could be added to future spreadsheets, I would greatly appreciate it.
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, if you look at the spreadsheet provided in your packets, there's a column labeled column number C or letter C. That is the November forecast. So that is this current spending as of this biennium in which we are in.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that the forecast amount or what was actually appropriated last session?
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, that is the forecasted amount. I'll add an asterisk to that. And in higher education, there are no forecasted programs. So the forecasted amount and the appropriated amount are nearly identical. They're not exactly identical, but they're essentially very, very similar, because the forecast doesn't necessarily change the appropriations which are made in law. Unlike a committee, say, like Human Services, which has formulaic-based appropriations, as well as, say, K-12 education, which has a formula per student. That does not exist within higher ed. So the amounts are essentially very similar.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins. Representative Scott.
thank you, Mr. Chair. So on this slide that we're on, of course they change and make FAFSA easier after my kids are out of there. and I'm wondering, it says that you're expecting several significant changes to the FAFSA form and to Pell Grant eligibility criteria. Do you have an idea of what that will look like? Is there a percentage of more students that you think will be eligible for these grants based on what you're hearing from the federal government?
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. There is also a packet, a FAFSA information sheet in your packet that you should have had today, so that will have some of that information provided. We anticipate that there will be both changes to the form itself, so there's a reduction in the overall number of questions, just in time for me to have high school students, so it's working out better for me than maybe it did for you. But an elimination from about almost 150 questions to, for some students, down to under 50 questions. So we're hoping that that the intention behind that is to make the form simpler. We'll both increase the likelihood that students will attempt the form and complete the form so that they can find out their Pell eligibility. An interesting fact is that according to recent research from the National College Attainment Network, Minnesota's high school graduating class of 2022 who didn't complete the FAFSA left over $46 million in Pell eligibility on the table. And so we know that there is a population of individuals who are Pell eligible but who just have not completed the FAFSA. So that's kind of the form and the structural changes. Some of the changes within the FAFSA Simplification Act will increase the number of students who are eligible. So they're eliminating barriers like the need to register for selective service if you're a male student, the prior prohibition on STEM students who had drug convictions and that impacting their aid eligibility. The most significant change is the elimination of something called the expected family contribution, or the EFC. That's the magic number that is used to determine what level of financial need a family has. In the simplest terms, the lower that number, the higher your financial need and the greater the amount of your Pell Grant you might get. Under the past FAFSA, that number bottomed out at zero. Under the new formula, which is called the Student Aid Index, that number will go negative. So a student could, our most needy students could have a number of minus 1,500. And so that shift will increase their eligibility for other need-based aid beyond the Pell Grant. And that's one of the changes that really requires us to adapt our state grant and state financial aid formulas to be able to account for a negative number and a lower threshold.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. My concern is that, and this has been like a proverbial problem, of the federal government gives more, so institutions of higher learning therefore raise their tuition because they can. And I don't know if there's anything we can do on the state level to say, hey, if more students are going to be eligible from a federal perspective, hey, higher education institution, there's a cap on what you can do as far as raising tuition, so that basically ends up being a nothing burger for these students as far as qualifications and what their out of pocket is. So maybe that's a rhetorical question.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, you had mentioned that part of this $18.7 million is for IT. Mm-hmm. Maybe I missed it, but how much of that 18 goes to IT so that we're in compliance and can do this easily?
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative O'Neill. It's about $1.5 million.
Okay. Thank you,
that's it. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. I had a question about some of the FAFSA changes. One of the things I've heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's not going to take into account multiple children in college. Can you help me understand how that change on the federal level would affect us on the state level and how we would, if we're anticipating that being a concern for families, I guess is my question.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members. Yes, that is something that is happening under the current historical way that FAFSA was awarded. If you happen to have, you know, one, two, or three family members in college, you would have, you know, if one person had an EFC of 5,000 and then another family member enrolled in college, their EFC would be split in half. So one would be 2,500 and one would be 2,500. Remember, the lower your EFC, the higher your aid eligibility is. So there was a little bit of a benefit for some students by having that second family member enroll, that they might become more aid eligible. That provision is going away in the new FAFSA Simplification Act. For many families, this may or may not have an impact on them. For some families who are maybe kind of on some of the cusps of eligibility and moved into Pell eligibility because that EFC was halved, it may actually have a negative impact on them.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for explaining that. Big family moms are panicking a little bit about that. And so I just was kind of wondering if our system would adjust, but it sounds like no, that is, it is what it is. And so when we calculate our state grant, that would be factored in, and that number would not be as high, right, for big families. If we have three kids in college, we're going to have the same expected family contribution for all three of those children.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair Kowalski. Yes, that's correct. One thing that's helpful to think about, and this is a little bit in the weeds on financial aid, is to remember that our Pell Grant and our state grant are in relationship with each other. So for some students, again, depending on income level, if their Pell Grant amount decreases, their state grant amount may increase. And so there will be some balancing that may happen with that. I don't have in front of me sort of our modeling numbers to be able to put more specific number to that, but those numbers do, as one adjusts, the other adjusts in the opposite direction.
Representative Hicks?
Oh,
proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, the next proposal is an increase in the Minnesota State Grant Program in the amount of $50 million. Over the biennium, Governor Walz is proposing this investment of $50 million in the biennium on the living and miscellaneous expense side of the state grant formula. For those who are familiar with the state grant formula, it's with the shared responsibility, designed for shared responsibility model, and the living and miscellaneous side of the formula does benefit lower and middle income students and allow those students more funding in their pockets. So the proposal is to, in the first biennium, raise the living and miscellaneous expense calculation to 120% of the federal poverty guideline, and then in the trailing biennium, increase that to 130% of federal poverty guideline. That average grant increase amount would increase in the first biennium of $345 per student. Adding this additional living and miscellaneous expense calculation also adds an additional approximate 680 students to state grant eligibility as well. Mr. Chair, members, the next proposal is the Minnesota American Indian Scholars Program. The governor is recommending $17 million over the biennium to establish the Minnesota American Indian Scholars Program. The proposal provides direct funding to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota, as well as the Board of Trustees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, to provide a first dollar tuition and fee-free pathway for eligible Minnesota American Indian students to complete an undergraduate education as part of the program. Funds in this program could also be utilized to provide student supports for eligible students, as well as for both public systems to be able to administer the program.
Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I thought I heard you say that this is an establishment. We didn't have this before, Mr. Commissioner.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, that's correct. It's a new program.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Okay, I must have missed it in the last biennium. It was hard when we were all remote, so I appreciate that. And it's good to see you in person, because seeing you on a little tiny screen, I didn't realize how tall you actually are. that was shocking, actually. So I really appreciate this. And the last time I looked at the attainment goals, 70% attainment goals for those that have at least a certification or other credential, Native American students were at 34%. And here you've got 29, which is close, but is that like the most recent number of 2022, or what's happened? Because I'm pretty sure that number I looked at was from 2021.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. I'm not aware of the American Indian educational attainment number being over 30%. We started with, I think, the baseline of around 22%, and have made incremental increases throughout the years. But I believe the current number reported here is the most recent.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. And Commissioner, thank you for that. Because I would also point out, which I'm sure you probably will too, that for white students, which is the highest at 68%, and our attainment goal is 70%. I've been around here almost a decade, and I remember when we put that into place, and I sat through several meetings about attainment and watched the numbers move very, very slightly, really, since we put the attainment goal in. One of the concerns I have is not only this, but I've said this before, but you weren't in the room, and I'm glad you're here right now. I really appreciate it. And Ms. Oliver has been here, I think, every day. It's been impressive, really. But one of the things that we've talked about is the wraparound services, especially for Native students. Is that something that the governor is also equally concerned about? And I appreciate the scholarship, and I know places like Morris, and they have a full-in scholarship, so Native students can go there with a full scholarship, things like that. But I had mentioned that Bemidji State, which is where I graduated from, has an entire resource center, American Indian Resource Center, and they have much higher completion numbers up there because of it. So I'm wondering if there's also kind of a coupling of the governor's, hopefully his the governor's initiative and budget, so not just a new scholarship program, but actually this encompassing wraparound service as well.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, thank you. Really appreciate the questions. A couple of things I would say. First is that, you know, I specifically mentioned when outlining this program the ability for both of the systems to utilize funding available not only for administration but also for student supports. It's also important to note that this program is proposed as a first dollar program. Mm-hmm. Meaning students can, you know, expect to receive predictable and sustainable financial aid each year through the waiver, and then free up additional, you know, funds for them that could be available through a Pell or state grant or other institutional aid or scholarships they may be eligible for. You know, that alone alleviates a lot of the concerns or potential concerns with students, you know, experiencing basic needs or, you know, resource gaps related to housing, transportation, food, childcare, and others. You know, and secondly, I would just say those wraparound services and basic needs services are addressed in other areas of the budget. Students could certainly be eligible. But I appreciate your attention on Bemidji State's American Indian Resource Center. Many of our campuses do have those specific resource centers for American Indian students. I actually grew up in the University of Minnesota Duluth American Indian Resource Center. My mom spent almost her entire career there, you know, so I know the services available that are provided there, as well as, you know, at the Twin Cities campus and other Minnesota State campuses as well, you know, St. Cloud in particular. So I appreciate you highlighting that, and, you know, these funds can certainly be utilized for those additional supports as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I really do appreciate that, because it's, you know, right now our workforce is 167,000 job openings and no one to fill them. We are basically at capacity with those that are looking for employment. And we need every single person in the workforce that's able and willing, able-bodied and willing, and maybe even some that are barely able-bodied. We take them too, I think, at this point. I say that because I look at what my own brother, who had been on this committee for many years here at the legislature, is doing with his considerable issues that he has. But, you know, we need every single person. And when I look at, I didn't realize it was as low as 29%. I must have had inaccurate charts in front of me, but that's, it's really sad. And we need each and every person to meet their full potential. So I just want to voice that. And I know I also will be signing on to a bill very shortly to support Red Lake in their, they are going to be doing a site for, because they have the Tribal College in Red Lake, and they're doing a site here in Minneapolis. And I'll be on that bill as well in offering my support for that, because I think it's really important. We have 50,000 Native people here in Minneapolis-St. Paul area that could benefit from that. So I just wanted to say that, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Neill, you forecasted the next proposal so well. The governor is recommending an appropriation of $3.7 million over the biennium to align the state's support of Minnesota tribal colleges with its support of other public institutions and public systems. This proposal utilizes an existing program that's in statute, the Tribal College Supplemental Grant Assistance Program, and proposes to expand the existing funding formula to include all students that attend tribal colleges, regardless of their status of enrollment in a federally recognized tribe. This proposal, as many of you may be aware, was in the final agreement in the supplemental bill last session. It looked a little differently, though. That bill proposed a flat appropriation to each of the three tribal colleges in the state rather than utilizing this existing program. So the governor's proposal is to utilize the existing program, but we are aware that there are bills that have been introduced this session by members looking at that old model. So this is the model the governor's recommending here, but certainly open to conversations about other opportunities with it.
Hi, Chair and committee members. Can you all hear me okay? For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Grants and Government Relations for the Office of Higher Education, and I'll be jumping in and out and sprinkling things here and there. For the next recommendation, it is the Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota. The governor is recommending an increase of $72,000 over the biennium, big dollars there, to support the program. The current base funding is $25,000 a year. The Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota pays for loan forgiveness for lawyers that are helping low-income underrepresented individuals in the state. So that's what this recommendation is for.
Mr. Chair and members, the next section of the budget recommendation centers around access. How do we create, how do we eliminate barriers for entry into higher education? From nursing assistant training to direct admissions, this is an area that the Office of Higher Education has been making great strides in over the last year, and even getting some national press over the initiatives. We're really proud of this work, and the governor and lieutenant governor's budget will continue to help us create pathways into post-secondary education in this area. Mr. Chair, once again, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Robinson to discuss the first couple of proposals.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. In the 2021 legislative session, the direct admissions pilot program was funded. This was an initiative designed to increase college access and college application behavior by kind of waiving application fees and by giving students the message that the state believes that all students who are graduating from our high schools are college material, and seeking to eliminate the anxiety around that "will I get in" question by affirmatively and proactively informing students of colleges and universities across the state that are eager and ready to accept them should they complete an application. We are in the midst of the pilot year this year, and we currently have 39 participating high schools, including some from some of your districts, and over 50 colleges and universities participating. The governor is recommending the governor's recommending $850,000 for staffing, implementation, communications, and IT modifications to allow us to continue and expand this program. Ultimately, we would like to scale to allow all 800 or so of Minnesota's high schools to participate.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, you made a comment that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. It says all graduates are college material. That's not true.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I think our belief is that anybody, student who's graduating from a Minnesota high school, should be qualified and prepared to pursue some sort of post-secondary training to pursue the job or career of their hope. That encompasses all manner of higher education, including our career and technical programs, our community colleges, our four-year private and four-year public institutions. This program does not suggest that everybody has to go to college, but we want to know that students to know that they have those opportunities and options available to them.
Representative David.
Okay, well, thank you. Not all graduates are college material, but point well taken. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative David brings up another issue, and we are having a joint hearing with the K-12 Finance Committee on February 14th, and it will be exclusively around preparing high school students with the option to have an employable skill set upon graduation from high school. This is a topic that we have discussed in this legislature since 2019 when we had the mini session in Winona, and we're going to have a much more detailed discussion of it on February 14th. I don't necessarily disagree with your observation, but I think we need a better interpretation of what that means upon graduation from high school. Commissioner Olson.
Mr. Chair, if I may, you know, we're working really hard at the Office of Higher Education to deliver a message that you know, post-secondary should be an option. And I know post-secondary doesn't always sound like, you know, the most plain language. Some folks do understand, you know, what college means, what opportunities for after high school mean. You know, we're really trying to make sure that Minnesota students, Minnesota high school graduates, you know, adult students that may be returning, folks looking to reskill or upskill, you know, whether that's a short-term credential, whether that's a, you know, a certificate program, a degree program. We want to make sure that we're not creating this unnecessary wedge either, right? When folks hear college, I think, you know, many equate college to only a four-year track. The way we talk about college at the Office of Higher Education, and we're hoping that, you know, all Minnesota students understand, is that means an opportunity for them for something beyond. I mean, we know that 70 plus, you know, jobs require some sort of credential beyond high school, you know, and maybe if not now, potentially into the future as well. And so, you know, we want to make sure that that's not a bifurcated message or decision. So I just want to note that too, because you will hear in some of our agency operations later on in the presentation some of our efforts around communications, and that's part of it too. So I really appreciate the conversation and message here, though.
Commissioner Olson, I appreciate that too. We have the two-year faculty here today. This is their day on the Hill. They're going to be a critical component of what we're going to be discussing throughout this session, and particularly on February 14th. So I'm glad you're pursuing the same line we are. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had said part of this money is for IT. How much is it for IT, and who's going to be building this database? And my concern is, see, I know Representative Noor just perked up when I said database. So my concern is that you're talking about massive amount of data, very private data, so it has to be constructed and construed properly, and the data must be, you know, comply with our statutes about data privacy and such. So I'm just wondering, how much is it going to cost, do we expect, and who's going to actually build it?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, if I may turn it to Dr. Robinson.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative O'Neill. Excuse me. I'll have to defer on the question of the exact percentage that's going to IT costs, but I do want to clarify that the IT is using the existing student information systems that the K-12 systems use to integrate that into this process. So there are six different, you know, Infinite Campus and a few other ones that are already data compliant with that information, and we'll be working to build that relationship following all of the appropriate data privacy. And then here comes my phone a friend, Meredith, to either correct me or provide more information.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the
record. Thank you, Chair Pulowski and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Burgess. I'm actually the Director of Research for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I co-manage direct admission, specifically the K-12 technology side. So we partnered with Infinite Campus this past year, and the goal for the data privacy is to minimize the data sharing needed for this project. So what we actually did is we partnered with the approved student information system vendors, and we actually had their software companies build a module that goes into their local system to do all of the calculations for the academic review, so that a minimum amount of data needs to be sent to our office. In fact, there's only about 8 data elements that gets transferred after the student opts into the program, and their parents get the FERPA notification, of course. And that's basically their name, their MARS number, what their academic calculation was, and then what colleges they've selected to go to. And that's the information that actually goes to the colleges. We truly tried to minimize it. Our goal, we weren't able to contract with the remaining vendors because there were federal modifications that had to be done this summer to EDFI and the other kind of federal compliance reporting. But our cost for Infinite Campus was $130,000 for 2 years of work. And so we anticipate that the other remaining 4 vendors would be approximately the same, and that we'll onboard them over the next 2 years. So we're actually, given that Infinite Campus wrote the initial specs, we actually might go lower than that. Yeah. For software that was built at the office, it was built with internal IT resources. And then our colleges were able to, because we simplified the file into a text format, we're able to import that data into their existing systems with minimal costs.
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, you cannot understand how happy I am right now, because this was a very long, Representative Knorr's happy too, I can see it, a conversation, and the fact that we're using outside vendors, thank you. That's going to be much more efficient, and I really appreciate the answer, and much more cost effective as well. So thank you, Ms. Fergus. I appreciate that very much. I do have one quick question, because you said opt in. So I believe when we were talking about this in the past, it was more of a data dump. So every student goes into this data pool and they figure out who, you know. But so you're talking about they have to opt into this. So each student now is an opt in to be. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Ms. Fergus. Ms. Fergus. Chair, Representative O'Neill. It's actually a two-part process. So data privacy at the K-12 level requires that a FERPA notification go out to the parents and guardians. Depending upon the district, we allowed the districts to choose whether direct admissions would be an opt-out for those parents and guardians or an opt-in. And we had some districts do each of both. So the opt-out districts, the parents just had to notify them that they didn't want their student to participate in the program, and therefore the academic calculation was never run. For the opt-in, only those students whose parents notified them they did want to participate had the academic calculation run. That said, the student still has to select, yes, I would like to be directly admitted to this college before we receive the information or before the college receives the information. So it's that two-part process.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has developed so much more than the last time we heard it. So much appreciated. Thank you, for Ms. Fergus, for working through all of those details. And the fact that it still holds quite a bit of local control, so the local school district, who is elected by their people, the school board's elected by their people, get to decide kind of how they want to implement it. This has really been developed quite far since the last time I heard it. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Our next proposal is the Transparent Pathway to Academic Credit for the Child Development Associate Credential Holder. The Child Development Associate Credential is one of the most widely recognized credentials for early education or early childhood education providers. So for our folks who are working in child care centers and preschools and sort of that pre-K level. And this credential ensures that our youngest Minnesotans are getting to getting care and education provided by people who've gone through some appropriate levels of training. This one-time funding request is to develop a transfer pathway for current Child Development Associate credential holders to be awarded academic credit to allow them to further their education. And we know there are ongoing concerns about the strength of our teacher workforce, and this is a path forward to allow folks to continue to grow and to develop and to further their career in early childhood education. Funds will be used to develop curriculum as well as training and advising tools for 8 colleges and universities. It will also form a statewide advisory committee to oversee the progress of this initiative. The governor recommends one-time funding of $475,000 for this initiative.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is the Next Generation Nursing Assistant Initiative. The governor is recommending $3 million over the biennium to continue the success of the Next Generation Nursing Assistant Initiative in partnership with Minnesota State. This proposal would provide ongoing funding to continue to provide a barrier-free pathway to employment for students participating and earning a certified nursing assistant credential. The proposal supports funding to pay for all costs associated with training, including the tuition, instruction, books and materials, scrubs, testing, as well as the certification test cost. Student supports are also included and necessary as a way to reduce barriers to completion and certification. Funding would also be available to pay for lab equipment upgrades, outreach, marketing, as well as administrative expenses for the Minnesota State Health Force Center of Excellence.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is such an important piece of higher education, and I fully support this program. What is the average cost per student, if you have that information, to go through the nursing assistant
Commissioner
program?
Olson.
Yeah, Chair Pawlowski, Representative Scott, I don't have an exact average. It's certainly something we can provide to you after. Part of the reason why I don't have an exact is that individual campuses, depending on how their training program was set up, were charging small differentials in terms of the tuition and associated fees. It was around $1,000. $1,000, I think, top was about $1,200 per student. And that's an all-in cost, scrubs, books, material, certification exam, which is about $250 to $300.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know the answer to this question, therefore I will ask it. Is there any data that's being kept as far as any of these students, or, and I know it's probably too early to even have an idea, but I'd like to see some data kept to see if any of these students go on to like full-blown nursing school or whatever like that, because that would certainly be a next step. And is that something that we could throw in? It would have to be done in a bill, I'm assuming, but I think that would be an important piece of data to keep.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, yeah, we are in the process right now of collecting longitudinal employment data. We actually received a small test file, an employment test file, from Minnesota State and some of our participating private training providers in the first round. That was sent to Department of Employment and Economic Development, kind of compared to UI data. We received a lot of files, and so staff at the Office of Higher Education have been working to, you know, match some of that data. You know, we do know that a majority of the participants indicated they are working in a health-related field, a healthcare-related field. We also want to take a look at, to your question, Representative Scott, students that may be still enrolled in college. That means they, you know, went on. Of course, the original intent of this program was to, you know, alleviate some of the pressure in our long-term care facilities, particularly in Greater Minnesota, keep them open. They were facing such a severe staffing shortage, and so certified nursing assistants were the immediate need, you know, but what a great additional benefit to have students launch their healthcare career in this way and potentially continue on.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was along that line too, and the report back as to of the 2,306 that went through, how many of them were placed, especially into nursing homes, because that was the highest need and that was sort of the impetus for the program. So once that data is complete, I'm really looking forward to a report back as to where they ended up. Are they where we hoped they would be, not just in the workforce, but specifically the high need areas like that? And also to Representative Scott's point that they may be continuing on and trying to achieve a higher degree. So that was my same question, and I look forward to the report back. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered if you could just explain a little bit the difference between when they're attending at community college or the 34 high school programs. Like, what's the breakdown of where students are getting this training? I personally did a similar program when I was a junior in high school. I became a nursing assistant. Decided that was not my career path, but it was really a fantastic program back in the day, and so I just wondered, you know, what's the breakdown of students currently, and what is your vision of that? Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, great question. I don't have the specific breakdown of high school participants versus those who were engaging with the course on campus. Certainly happy to provide that to you. You know, we do know there were well over a couple of hundred students that took the high school path, and those were students that were participating in existing programs that were available on their high school campus. You know, it leads, Mr. Chair, into the discussion you're going to have with the joint hearing. You know, these were robust career and technical ed programs on high school campuses. You know, one of the most important parts of both of these initial rounds of funding were that, you know, we wanted to provide significant support to high schools in the form of infrastructure and equipment grants, making sure that, you know, high school students that were choosing to participate there had the most up to date and reliable equipment to train on. We do know that, you know, some of the students that participated at the high school level actually, you know, went on to take the certification exam because they had the ability to do so, where typically, you know, they engage in the coursework but choose not to actually be listed on the nursing assistant registry. And so
You know, that's a success story in and of itself, and tells us that, you know, that simple certification exam fee waiver, you know, was probably a barrier for a lot of high school students, and, you know, eliminating that, we hope to, you know, to grow those high school participation numbers even further if this is funded to continue.
Professor Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. As part of all this reporting back, if you could also identify how many high school students completed the course and how many did get the certification, that would be helpful.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, members, the next recommendation is an increase to Minitex online library systems. The increase is $1.35 million over the biennium. This is to increase the nursing resources that are provided. That will help with nursing telehealth. It would also, by providing the statewide resources, it would allow for local libraries to free up other resources that they can use in other areas.
Mr. Chair, the third section is centered around attainment. This, of course, is at the heart of our agency mission, and we've discussed attainment already a little bit here this morning. You know, since the legislature established the statewide educational attainment goal in 2015, all of our work really has been centered around this attainment goal. You know, I absolutely love the measure of attainment. It's not just about enrolling more students, it's about retention. It's about ensuring that every student has the support they need to finish their degree program. The governor and lieutenant governor's budget advances attainment and aims to advance attainment by creating new supports for students who have children, providing additional resources for students facing housing and food insecurity, and increases the number of teacher candidates we can support through our teacher training grants and supports. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Nikki Oliver to introduce the next couple of proposals in this section.
Director Oliver.
Chair, members, even prior to COVID, there was a need for emergency assistance to students to help retain them for short-term emergencies. So the office administered the Emergency Assistance for Post-Secondary Students program. The funding that we had available for that program did not meet the application needs we saw from students, from institutions and students. The governor is recommending increasing funding to this program, as you've heard from the systems and probably student groups. During COVID, there was COVID funding to support emergency needs for students. Those emergencies have not gone away for students. So the governor is recommending an increase to the program of $4.3 million over the biennium. And that will also allow us to increase the maximums for per institutions and also the maximum caps for student emergency awards from $1,000 to $1,500 a student.
Chair and members of the committee, our next initiative is a student parent support initiative. As we've had our conversations around declining enrollment and our attainment gap, we know that we cannot address either of those challenges by solely focusing on our traditional high school, fresh out of high school into college student population. And so this is one of those initiatives designed to really support adult learners who happen to be parenting dependent children. The Minnesota Student Parent Support Initiative will address health and educational needs of parenting students in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health. This will establish a competitive grant program that will provide up to $350,000 per institution for post-secondary institutions to create, scale, or build capacity for serving parenting students. In Minnesota, we know that there are about 39,000 single parents over the age of 25 who have some college but no degree. And we also know that there are an additional 30,000 single parents over the age of 25 who have not earned any college credit yet. This is an initiative that really represents a sound financial investment for the state because we know that parenting students who complete their credential typically have higher levels of economic stability moving forward and a greater ability to provide for their family, and it ultimately results in reducing benefits eligibility for other income support programs later on. The governor is recommending $13.4 million to support this initiative.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to Bemidji State University, because I know the most about it, and I just toured there again and just talked to their brand new president. And what was so, as a, you know, average student there, it was really impressive to me that they actually had apartments within the dorms specifically for parents with children. It was really, really impressive. And on in that same building, they have a child care center. So I don't know how widespread that model is, but it, do you happen to know how widespread that is? Because that certainly was something that really, really helped those older than average students that I went to school with. It helped them to achieve things that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And I'm hoping that this actually works in that sort of model, because it's you're right there on campus. You've got all the support of your RA and your staff in that building. You've got the child care center right there. You've got students that staff the child care center. It's just this great collaboration of students and staff and faculty all together. So I'm just wondering, how does this work with that sort of a model?
Sure. I'm so excited. Chair Pulaski and Representative O'Neill. And I will, in a moment, defer to Miriam Cullimore, who can share some more of that data. One of the things I do think is important about the way that this initiative is structured is that as a competitive grant program, it will allow each campus to look at their own student population to best identify what are the needs of their population. Is it on-campus child care support? Is it a resource center? Is it, you know, it will look different things depending on whether it's a residential campus or, you know, a rural campus versus an urban campus. And so there will be a lot of flexibility for the campuses to determine how to best meet the needs of their students. But I'm going to turn it over to Miriam to talk a little bit more about the model that you saw.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. So specifically,
please identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, thank you. My name is Miriam Cullimore. I serve as the student, parent, and whole family coordinator for the Office of Higher Education. In terms of the sort of dual service model that you're talking about, where there is housing as well as a child care center on campus for student parents, only a handful of campuses are able to provide that service in that model. I would say that if my memory serves me correctly, there's about 5 or 6 campuses that offer any kind of housing for parenting students on campus. There are a couple that offer off-campus housing options that they've partnered with others in the community to provide. I know there's one campus, there are 2 campuses that have combined their resources to provide some type of housing for parenting students. But I can get you a specific number as to how many, but it is a very small number. I would say less than 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cullimore, while you're here, this committee once upon a time toured the campuses of the MnState system, and one of the priorities was daycare, mm-hmm. whether the campus had it, and if they had it, the quality of the daycare. Do you know right offhand how many of the campuses maintain daycare?
Are you talking specifically MnState?
I'm talking MnState primarily.
MnState primarily. I will tell you I don't have the exact number on hand, but across the state there are 20 campuses that have a child care center of any kind on campus or that they've partnered off campus with. And I would say a fair number of them are MnState campuses.
If you can get the specific data to us, I'd appreciate it, because we had issues, the COVID related probably, but maintaining the daycare in an era of declining enrollment has been extremely difficult.
Yes.
And when the Education Village was done at Winona State, part of that was to create a daycare center that was to service the community and the college. So I'd appreciate a report on that.
Yes, I can get you those numbers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. One thing I think is really important, Mr. Chair, to this point is the fact that students can actually work. And I remember when I was an undergrad at Bemidji State, that was one of the options for me to do a small internship with my applied psychology degree, was actually to work in the center. So it's such a, you know, it's students helping students. The students get to work there. At least they did, you know, some 20 years when I was there. But it's such a model that I'm really sad that only 5 or 6 campuses in the entire state of Minnesota have this collaborative work between having, you know, an on-site dorm that's a little bit big enough to have children there and then have a child care center right there staffed by some of the students that you go to school with. So this seems like a missed opportunity, Mr. Chair, that we should explore more.
Representative O'Neill, I agree completely, but with the issue that we have with declining enrollment and funding, it's very tenuous to even maintain a daycare center. And we've gone through that in my area, and we maintained it. But it was not without significant input from the community that it was done. And I think it is a critical component of higher ed to have a daycare center. And I would agree with you with the parental part of it, too. So a report on this would be appreciated, and hopefully we'll be able to help you when we get the budget put together.
Thank you so much.
All right, proceed.
Chair members, not to belabor this, but for the student parent support initiative, that is one of the things we're encouraging is more community partnerships, because we know systems can't sustain those child care centers themselves. So we look to like business partnerships, other community organization partnerships in building that, and that's also why it's written more of a, as a competitive grant. So the next few slides are related to teachers. As even once again prior to COVID, Minnesota has been dealing with kind of teacher workforce shortages, and that has been exacerbated throughout COVID. The governor is recommending increased funding to several teacher programs we have that we administer in the office, one of them being the underrepresented student teacher grants. This program supports student teachers while they're doing their student teaching. Students receive up to $7,500 in grants. And the current appropriation has not met the need seen in these programs. So that's why the increase is being recommended. Same for the grants to student teachers in shortage areas. This one is specifically for teachers teaching in shortage licensure or demographic geographic areas.
Representative Neal.
Thank you. So I was just looking at the spreadsheet, and I don't see the appropriation amount in the current biennium. What is the current amount?
Mr. Saver.
Chair and members, for a point of clarification, the sheet that was included in your packet are change items only. The base amounts reflect the overall base amount for the agency. So for example, you'll see in column D and E, it's labeled base and base tails, and it has a total for the agency, but there's no program-by-program breakdown for ones that are in law currently. But I will tell you that for the underrepresented portion, there is $1.125 million in each fiscal year in the base, so a total of $2.250 million of base appropriations in FY 24 and 25, and also into the tails.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I've noticed that in a couple of the slides is that you've mentioned that it's an increase, but if you could tell us what the base is, that's super helpful, because unfortunately we don't have that in our spreadsheet. So if you could fill in those blanks, that'd be awesome, really, really helpful. Thank you, Ms. Oliver.
Absolutely.
Director Oliver.
Chair, members, the other teacher program that we administer in our office is a teacher shortage loan repayment program. This program was established to keep teachers who are working in the workforce currently staying in the workforce. And as was mentioned before, debt, student debt is always a barrier. So this program helps pay qualified educational loans of teachers teaching in specific shortage areas. The increase will allow us to service the amount of applications we get of eligible teachers who are applying for this program. The base for this program is currently only $200,000 a year. Nope, I talked about it. Yep. The next recommendation from the governor is we have a program called the Intervention for College Attendance Program. This program is targeted towards colleges, nonprofit organizations, and other community organizations that service students, sixth grade through some post-secondary and some post-secondary students, to the point that was made earlier by Representative Davids and Chair Pawlowski, help individuals be college ready. Most of our ICAP programs have a greater graduation rate than the state average in the 90 percentiles. So this one-time increase in the ICAP program will allow us, one, to cover programs that we were able to fund with limited American Rescue Plan funding. And then also a part of this funding will allow us to do a temporary expansion to service programs that who service students who were formerly incarcerated. Programs like American OIC, American Indian OIC, Summit Academy, and even Minneapolis College has some things they would love to do that helps formerly incarcerated individuals get them college ready and into college.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd like to address the governor's proposals in support of our overall agency operations and mission. The governor is recommending funding in the amount of $3.2 million over the biennium in funding necessary for the Office of Higher Education in order to maintain our current services to students and institutions. The governor's recommendation includes funding necessary to support contract negotiated compensation increases, IT cost increases, additional communications funding, as well as two additional FTE to continue operations within the agency.
Chair and members of the committee, one of our requests is for one of the governor's recommendations is for support for the Minnesota statewide longitudinal education data system, otherwise known as SLEDS, and Minnesota's early childhood longitudinal data system, known as ECLDS. These are nation-leading data systems that allow us to provide critical information to counties, to state higher education systems, to the public, to researchers, to the legislature, and other agencies to answer critical questions like, who is going to college and where do they go? What are the employment outcomes for folks who have earned a post-secondary credential? How are we serving our youngest Minnesotans? And what was the impact of the pandemic on enrollment and attainment? This request is partially due to SLEDS was receiving funds through a federal grant, and we've come to the end of that federal grant cycle. And so this ask largely allows for continuity of operations, as well as investments in IT projects, including needed hardware and software updates. Funds will also be used for the purchase of necessary external data from the National Student Clearinghouse, which allows us to understand what's happening at the national level, as well as supporting ongoing staffing, outreach, and training materials.
Oh, Rep. Sam Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little teeny detail, because I'm a data person, as you know. Could you build into these databases audit trails, please, so that anytime that data is shared, that can be tracked? Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next proposal. The governor is recommending funding in the amount of $277,000 over the biennium to support the hire of a tribal relations director at the Office of Higher Education. This position will ensure the agency meets the statutory obligation that every state agency identify a tribal liaison to oversee, direct, and lead all agency programs and activities related to tribal relations. The Tribal Relations Public Engagement and Equal Opportunity Director will provide expert advice, policy direction, and support to the agency on issues affecting the community and tribal nations. They'll work in concert with agency communications and government relations to build public affairs strategies that can grow government-to-government tribal relations and community engagement. Mr. Chair and members, the governor's also recommending funding in the amount of $277,000 over the biennium to support the hire of an executive director of the Minnesota P20 Partnership. This position will be responsible for the planning, direction, coordination, and day-to-day operations of the P20 Partnership. The executive director has the overall responsibility to manage the duties of the partnership, including developing long-term strategic goals, biennial budget requests, management of personnel funding and resources in collaboration with the P20 Partnership Executive Committee. Now, although this request is in the governor's budget for the Office of Higher Education, I wanted to note here that this is actually a shared position between the membership of the P20 Council, including the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State College and University System, the Minnesota Department of Education, and of course the Office of Higher Education. All entities involved in that comprise the Executive Council have agreed to provide support and share costs associated with the position in support of the overall statewide P20 partnership.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how I don't know this. I'm not real familiar with P20, and I'm just wondering, since it's been around since 2009, can you just do a high level, like one or two accomplishments from P20?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, correct. P20 established in 2009 and established in statute, actually. A couple of the recent accomplishments of the P20 Council are actually to look at, of course, the overall charge of the P20 Council is really birth through workforce. It is the governance arm and oversight arm of the statewide longitudinal educational data system, as well as ECLDS, the early childhood component. The committee over the last 2 years actually worked with an organization called the Education Strategy Group, as well as the Joyce Foundation, to look at four different areas of work, one being credentials of value, also looking at the affordability issue across the entire state's spectrum, looked as well at data, data systems management and improvements, and actually the P20 just recently submitted a report to the legislature, and we can make that available to all the members here on those accomplishments, as well as recommendations around those four core work group areas that have been taking place over the last couple of years. Some really important I think, findings, as well as recommendations for potential future legislative action.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Olson, do you know who the current member of the House appointed by the Speaker to the P20 is? Has that been accomplished yet?
Chair Pawlowski, I do not. The last representative from the House, I believe, was Representative Damoth.
So, members, if you're interested in an appointment, that may be an option for you. I don't know. Okay, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Want to round out the presentation here. I know we've been here a long time talking a lot, but appreciate the opportunity here. So the final transition section of the budget here is outlining the governor's recommendation for support to Minnesota public higher education systems. So both the Minnesota state system and the University of Minnesota, of course, like I had mentioned at the top, have testified and shared their budget recommendations here in the committee. My comments will be limited to the governor's recommendations for each of the systems. Before that, though, I want to note that the governor is recommending an appropriation of $896,000 over the biennium, providing appropriations for the Mayo Clinic. This proposal seeks to include the 15 residents appointed to the Mankato-based Family Medicine Residency Program, as well as increasing appropriations for the Rochester Program to account for additional rising costs that have been identified. The Mankato program was moved from the University of Minnesota to the Mayo Clinic recently, and the Rochester program currently includes 9 residents. So, Mr. Chair and members, for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, the governor is recommending an appropriation of $131.5 million over the biennium, as well as $180 million in the following biennium to support Minnesota State's request for student support, campus stabilization support, and workforce and economic development initiatives. The large majority of the governor's recommendation for Minnesota State includes the system's complete request for campus stabilization at $125 million over the biennium. And the recommendation also funds the expansion of student mental health resources and basic needs resources in the student support section. And finally, also supports the workforce and economic development proposal for increased scholarships and workforce programming within the system.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at the numbers that have been recommended by the governor in terms of the Min State, I think their request was up to 350, and this shows it's only 38% of the request from the Min State. I know we'll cover the next slide. big, huge difference from what they're requesting. It's already been 50%. What criteria are we looking into in terms of supporting the institutions who are saying they needed more, but we have got less from the governor's recommendation?
Mr. Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr. Appreciate the question, and you know, fully recognize that this is not the Minnesota State System's full request. In looking at the total request, the governor heard from numerous stakeholders, including students and faculty, who shared with the governor that you know, one of the biggest difficulties on campus is actually the availability of appropriate courses to complete a degree program. I know we within the office, as well as the governor, heard from students who had to add an additional semester or potentially even an additional year onto their program because, you know, their program of study or that final class that they may have needed was not available, you know, due to program closures, due to the you know, the potential and real, you know, retrenchment of faculty. That was heard loud and clear, and so the governor over everything prioritized that campus stability and support, making sure that, you know, what's available on campus is at least maintained and has the ability to be built out, but, you know, fully recognize that the system's request for other financial aid components, as well as tuition relief, tuition freeze, is not represented there. We feel as though some of the other targeted proposals within the budget do address some of those financial aid requests, just in different and more targeted ways rather than an across-the-board investment.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you so much for that clarity. And also, I don't want to jump to the next slide where we have the University of Minnesota. They requested 205. We're funding them at 70. You know, appreciate to see that the safety is being pushed into the tails, but when the need is right now, I don't think we have the luxury of putting things on the side. So we're also funding them at 34%, which is not even close to 50, you know, in comparison. I think this is significantly lower than what the, you know, University of Minnesota is requesting. And how do you really close those gaps as we look into the budget this year?
Mr. Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, appreciate you highlighting the University of Minnesota request as well. And this actually is our final slide here. So if it's okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I can just walk through it and then answer your question.
Commissioner, it is. And when you're done walking through that, I want to walk through this one again.
All right, appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So for the University of Minnesota, the governor is recommending, as Representative Knorr, you had noted, a total of $73 million over the biennium, as well as $90 million the following biennium to support the University of Minnesota's requests, of course, for core mission support, as well as campus and security, campus safety and security funds, and appropriations related to recommendations for the Minnesota Clean Water Council. The majority of the governor's recommendation for the University of Minnesota includes a significant portion of the university system's request for operations and maintenance funding. Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, again, I would share similar comments that I had shared for Minnesota State, fully recognizing that this, you know, is not the full systems request of $205 million, of which $135 million over the biennium was for core campus support and stability. So this is you know, this is where the governor chose to prioritize in that core mission support piece, but, you know, understand there are some components missing, and, you know, I will just say look forward to working really closely here with the committee and the legislature as a whole to potentially round this out.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. But I'm also looking through the capital investment, which I know doesn't come through the OHIO. The governor, you know, the governor's recommendation is even lower in all those sectors compared to what the institutions have requested. So I think we've got more work to do, Mr. Chair. I know you wanted to do the walkthrough, so I'll let you do that section. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to go to Representative Wolgamott, and then Representative Wolgamott. Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner, you want to respond?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, thank you, and appreciate you raising the capital investment recommendation from the governor. I know you shared it in committee last week, I think real time, when the system was here walking through their recommendation, Minnesota State System, I should note. You know, I will just say the governor took the entire capital investment recommendation bill from last year, and that is the recommendation this year. I do know there is, for Minnesota State, for example, about a $27 million gap in HEPR. Other than that, the entire 19 project list is recommended by the governor, as well as a significant portion of the HEPR funds as well. And so I know the system's new request did have a little bit of additional funding recommended for this year, and I know certainly the governor is open to open to addressing that recommendation as well.
Representative Bogle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner Olson, first I just want to start off by saying thank you for being here today and for this thoughtful proposal that you're putting forward with the governor. There are a lot of good things in here that I'm really excited to work with you to get over the finish line and build off a lot of the work that we've done in past years to support student success for the students that I represent, both at St. Cloud State University, St. Cloud Technical Community College, and students all throughout the state. That being said, I do want to reiterate the concerns that were brought forward by Representative Knorr about the low funding for recommendations for higher education, and particularly at the University of Minnesota. You know, again, funding only 34% of the core operations and management requests, $0 for public safety in the next biennium, and the thing that concerns me the most is there's $0 for scholarship programs that are designed to boost enrollment at Greater Minnesota campuses. As the chair has said, this committee is really focused in on boosting enrollment, turning that around, particularly in the schools in Greater Minnesota. So I wanted to express that. I'm grateful that you mentioned to Representative Knorr that you and your team and the governor are committed to working with this committee to solve these problems. So I wanted to express those concerns, but also say that, we've done good work in the past, and I'm grateful that I have every expectation that we can, work together with this committee, with you, with the governor, and get these numbers to where they need to be to solve these problems and particularly make sure we're turning around the enrollment crisis.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Representative Wolgamott. I'll just say thank you. Appreciate you, raising that, and noted. I hear you loud and clear.
Commissioner Olson, I requested from the Minnesota State System a breakdown of what they would have to cut campus by campus if they got the entire request that they put before us, and we'll be receiving that data soon. Was there any consideration by the governor, given this number, what those campuses would have to cut if this was their budget number, campus by campus?
Yeah, Chair Pawlowski, I'm looking forward to seeing that as well. I know typically when the system prepares numbers like that for the committee, we're provided a courtesy copy for consideration as well. That is something I'll certainly share with the governor and have further discussions about. I can't reiterate enough though that realizing there are still potential cuts if the entire system request is not received and realized. That is why, though, the governor fully supported the system stabilization request. That is why that was priority number one. He heard that over and over again from the system. He heard it from faculty leadership groups as well. I'm certainly not going to speak for them. I know, we have some incredible faculty behind me here today that are planning to share plenty of stories with you throughout the day, but that is what we heard, that the campus stabilization and maintenance of what we have right now is of utmost importance over, other tuition relief, understanding that that's important to students, but campus stabilization was key.
Commissioner Olson, we were informed last week that Bemidji State had a meet and confer where they were proposing potential layoffs. And Bemidji State is one of the campuses that we took a look at over a 10-year span with declining enrollment. My concern with this budget is that we have a 10-year problem here that isn't getting any better. and that we have to do some type of an assistance to these campuses. Plus, we need workers. We need trained workers. That's the other part of the issue. So our concern is huge. We do have resources that are available, but I want to make sure we put those resources in the right place so that we can start addressing the concerns that are out there. So I'm looking forward to the numbers, too, and I would request, I see the systems out there, if it's possible to tell us what the cuts would be with the governor's recommendations, and you could do a side-by-side, campus-by-campus, that would be appreciated. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you were headed in the same direction. I'm just wondering if a local impact statement has been done for these funding numbers. I just find them to be extremely low, and the institutions themselves provide a tremendous amount of local impact all over our state. And if these numbers are kept at the recommendation, what is that going to do to the local economies, in addition to the students who would be served by those institutions? You know, there's no free here, right? So every dollar that we cut has to be paid for somewhere. And so who's going to pick up the slack there? Is it, and then how do we keep the programs necessary to allow matriculation, right? I mean, you can't do one without the other. So thank you very much.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cleavorn, appreciate that. And, you know, I agree as well. You know, I will just note, I don't know what difference this necessarily makes at this moment in time, but was reading this morning an article that came from Inside Higher Ed, and it was an analysis of some of the recent statistics released from the National Center of Education Statistics, NCES, that's showing, at least at a national level, enrollment increasing slightly. You know, I have yet to see, you know, how that translates to Minnesota, but it is an encouraging sign. A couple of the recommendations from that analysis were, you know, that for the most part, and again, this is a broad statement, you know, our large four-year private nonprofits, you know, are doing fairly well, stable. You know, I know we have two-year faculty in the room here. Our community colleges are struggling the most, not only nationally, but here in Minnesota as well with enrollment. The recommendations of the analysis did point to students of color, low-income students, first-gen students, you know, underserved populations of students still not showing up in some of these enrollment trends. And so, you know, it's ever important, of course, that we address overall campus stability, overall tuition numbers, affordability, but also to ensure that there's targeted resources necessary for students that, you know, we would like to show up on our campuses, but unfortunately, you know, haven't yet been represented in those enrollment numbers. So potentially, a good turn of the tide here, but of course, you know, we know we're digging out of a very deep hole.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Olson, I know you are wholly dedicated to higher education. The piece that concerns me is if we are cutting the systems back, I'll just say it this way. It's not an or, right? These are not an or. It's not an, are we going to fund students who are of lower socioeconomic ability, or are we going to fund the institutions? We have to find a way to do the and. And so I appreciate yours and your team's commitment to higher education, but we've got to find a better way to do this. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill and then Representative Davids, and we've got about 5 minutes left.
Just really quickly, just to Representative Cleavorn's point, you know, I remember being back at Bemidji State, and we always joked to say, well, as soon as students came, there were 5,000 more residents of Bemidji. And actually, I was looking at their numbers, and in 13, they had 6,000, almost 350 people, which is more than when I was there, but they've lost over 1,000 in the last decade, which is to the point. But it, you know, I used to work at a downtown store, and the students themselves are adding a lot to the community, but when you lose them, and what we've been talking about this whole time, it does impact the whole community. So I know I've had Bemidji State professors come in too, and they said, I can't remember the number they said, because they did tell me a number how many faculty they'd have to cut, but it was significant. And the other thing about that as well is when you talk about HEPR, there are buildings at Bemidji State that are, they have Steinways that have been donated and purchased with private funds, and they're not in good condition because of mold and humidity and such, and that the building that they're housed in. So there's, I'm glad that we're at least doing HEPR, but it's, there are a lot of pent-up HEPR needs all over the system. I just wanted to mention that since Representative Cleburne did say that, and I literally saw it when I was on the campus of Bemidji State. We joked about it, you know, that you'd have all of these extra people come. I know it's, you know, over 6,000 students that show, and that's the head count, not the FTEs, but the actual people showing up to participate in the community. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cleburne made a comment about cutting systems back. All the, you know, I'm new here, and all of the presentations we've had are spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions more when we have a declining enrollment of X, whatever that is. Is there any talk in the governor's office about how at some point, I know it's no fun, in business you'd have to do it, about right-sizing?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, yeah, thank you for the question, and I know that same question was posed to the chancellor as well. You know, I certainly don't want to speak for, you know, the decisions that potentially need to be made within each of the systems. It is something that is a national question. You know, I think when Vice Chancellor Mackey was going through the budget, you know, noted some of the consolidations that have taken place already within the Minnesota State system. You know, the creation of the Minnesota North Campus, pulling five campuses together under the leadership of one. You know, I know that is carefully considered by the Board of Trustees and, you know, by the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota as well. And so, you know, we're monitoring those conversations closely within the office. Of course, we don't have any, you know, authority over that. That is solely within the authority and governance of the respective boards, but you know, we do know that this is more than a Minnesota conversation, and other states are, you know, considering options as well.
Well, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want the Minnesota conversation. I'm not into the national conversation, and I just think, you know, we're talking, like I said, we talk about spending hundreds of millions of dollars. I bet we're well over $1 billion for a system that is declining in enrollment, and I think at some point we have to be realistic here. How do we explain to our constituents that we put $1.6 billion in higher ed with 30% less students, or whatever that number is, you know, whatever that number is. So not for today, but something to consider, that we got to talk about right sizing. That's hard. I've had to do it before in my private business, and it's hard, but I haven't heard anything in any of the testimony so far about what we have to do.
Representative Davids, you make an excellent point, and the hearing on the 14th with the K-12 Finance Committee begins that discussion of restructuring both the K-12 system and the higher ed system to address the problems that we face. So I agree, there's going to have to be some restructuring here, and there's going to have to be realignment in both systems in order to get us out of this. So any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Meeting Mr. Chair, members, thank you.